Cedar Lane, copyright 1990 by Carl Edward Wagner, originally published in Walls of Fear, read by Goblin Hood. Dream is a shadow of something real, from the Peter Weir film The Last Wave. He was back at Cedar Lane again, in the big house where he had spent his childhood, growing up there until time to go away to college. He was the youngest, and his parents had sold the house then, moving into something smaller and more convenient in a newer and nicer suburban development. A rite of passage, but for Garrett Larkin it truly reinforced the reality that he could never go home again, except in dream, and dreams are what the world is made of. At times it puzzled him that while he nightly dreamed of his boyhood home in Cedar Lane, he never dreamed about any of the houses he had lived in since. Sometimes the dreams were scary, sometimes more so than others. It was a big two-story house plus basement built just before the war in which he was born. It was very solid, faced with thick stones of pink-hued Tennessee marble from the local quarries. There were three dormer windows thrusting out from the roof in front, and Garrett liked to call it the House of the Three Gables because he always thought the Hawthorne book had a neat, spooky title. He and his two brothers each had his private hideout in the little dormer rooms, just big enough for shelves, boxes of toys, a tiny desk for making models or working jigsaw puzzles. Homework was not to intrude here, relegated instead to the big desk in Dad's never-used study in the den downstairs. Cedar Lane was an old country lane laid out probably at the beginning of the previous century along dirt farm roads, now two narrow lanes of much repaved blacktop, twisted through a narrow gap curtained between rows of massive cedar trees. Garrett's house stood well back upon 4 acres of lawn, orchards, and vegetable garden, portioned off from farmland as the neighborhood shifted from rural to suburban just before the war. It had been a wonderful house to grow up in, 3 boys upstairs and a sissy older sister with her own bedroom downstairs across the hall from Mom and Dad. There were 2 flights of stairs to run down, the other leading to the cavernous basement, where Dad parked a new car and had all his shop tools and gardening equipment, and where dwelt the Malachian coal furnace named Fear and its nether realms, the monster-haunted coal cellar. The yard was bigger than any of his friends had, and until he grew old enough to have to mow the grass and cuss, it was a limitless playground to run and romp with the dogs, for ball games and playing cowboy or soldier, for climbing trees and building secret clubhouses out of boxes and scrap lumber. Garrett loved the house on Cedar Lane, but he wished that he wouldn't dream about it every night. Sometimes he wondered if he might be haunted by the house. His shrink told him it was purely a fantasy longing for his banished childhood. Only it wasn't. Some of the dreams disturbed him, like the elusive fragrance of autumn leaves burning and the fragmentary remembrance of carbonizing flesh. Garrett Larkin was a very successful landscape architect with his own offices and partnership in Chicago. He had kept the same marvelous wife for going on 30 years, was just now putting the youngest of their 3 wonderful children through Antioch, was looking forward to a comfortable and placid 5th decade of life, and had not slept in his bed at Cedar Lane since he was 17. Garrett Larkin awoke in his bed in the house on Cedar Lane, feeling vaguely troubled. He groped over his head for the black metal cowboy silhouette wall lamp mounted above his bed. He found the switch, but the lamp refused to come on. He slipped out from beneath the covers, moved through familiar darkness into the bathroom, thumbed the light switch there, He was filling a drinking glass with water when he noticed that his hands were those of an old man. An old man's hands, not his hands. Not his, the face in the bathroom mirror, lined with too many years, too many cares. Hair gray and thinning, nose bulbous and flecked with red blotches. Left eyebrow missing the thin scar from when he totaled the Volvo. Hands heavy with calluses from manual labor. No wedding ring, none too clean flannel pajamas loose over a too thin frame. He swallowed the water slowly, studying the reflection. It could have been him. Just another disturbing dream. He waited for the awakening. He walked down the hall to his brother's room. There were two young boys asleep there. Neither one was his brother. They were probably between 9 and 13 years in age, and somehow they reminded him of his brothers long ago, when they were all young together on Cedar Lane. One of them stirred suddenly and opened his eyes. He looked up at the old man silhouetted by the distant bathroom light. He said sleepily, "What's wrong, Uncle Gary?"
"Nothing. I thought I heard one of you cry out. Go back to sleep now, Josh."
The voice was his, and the response came automatically. Garrett Larkin returned to his room and sat there on the edge of his bed, awaiting daylight. Daylight came, and with the smell of coffee and frying bacon, and still the dream remained. Larkin found his clothes in the dimness, dragged on the familiar overalls, and made his way downstairs. The carpet was new and much of the furniture was strange, but it was still the house on Cedar Lane, only older. His niece was bustling about the kitchen. She was pushing the limits of 30 in the seams of her house dress, and he had never seen her before in his life.
"Morning, Uncle Gary." She poured coffee into his cup. "Boys up yet?"
Garrett sat down in his chair at the kitchen table, blew cautiously over the coffee. "Dead to the world." Lucille left the bacon for a moment and went around to the stairway. He could hear her voice echoing up the stairwell.
"Dwayne, Josh, rise and shine. Don't forget to bring down your dirty clothes when you come. Shake a leg now."
Martin, his niece's husband, joined them in the kitchen, gave his wife a hug, and poured himself a cup of coffee. He stole a slice of bacon.
"Morning, Gary. Sleep well?"
"I must have." Garrett stared at his cup. Martin munched over crisp bacon.
"Need to get those boys working on the leaves after school."
Garrett thought of the smell of burning leaves and remembered the pain of vaporizing skin. And the coffee seared his throat like a rush of being boiled, like a rush of boiling blood, and he awoke. Garrett Larkin gasped at the darkness and sat up in bed. He fumbled behind him for the cowboy silhouette wall lamp, couldn't find it. Then there was light, a lamp on the nightstand from the opposite side of the king-sized bed. His wife was staring at him in concern.
"Gare, are you okay?"
Garrett tried to compose his memory. "It's all right, Rachel. Just another bad dream is all."
"Another bad dream? Yet another bad dream, you mean? You sure you're telling your shrink about these?"
"He says it's just a nostalgic longing for childhood as I cope with advancing maturity."
"Must have been some happy childhood. Okay if I turn out the light now?"
And he was dreaming again, dreaming of Cedar Lane. He was safe and snug in his own bed in his own room, furled beneath Mom's heirloom quilt against the October chill that penetrated the unheated upper story. Something pressed hard into his ribs, and he awoke to discover his Boy Scout flashlight was trapped beneath the covers, along with the forbidden EC horror comic books he'd been secretly reading after bedtime. Gary thumbed on the light, turning it about his room. Its beam was sickly yellow because he needed fresh batteries, but it zigzagged reassuringly across the bedroom walls, made familiar by their airplane posters, blotchy paint-by-numbers oil paintings, and, a seasonal addition, cut-out Halloween decorations of jack-o'-lanterns and black cats, broom-riding witches and dancing skeletons. The beam probed into the dormer, picking out the shelved books and treasures, the half-completed B-36 flying cigar nuclear bomber rising above a desk strewn with plastic parts and tubes of glue. The flashlight's fading beam shifted to the other side of his room and paused upon the face that looked down upon him from beside his bed. It was a grown-up's face, someone he'd never seen before, ghastly in the yellow light. At first, Gary thought it must be one of his brothers in a Halloween mask, and then he knew it was really a demented killer with a butcher knife, like he'd read about in the comics. And then the flesh began to peel away in blackened strips from the spotlit face, and bare bone and teeth charred and cracked apart into evaporating dust, and Gary's bladder exploded with a rush of steam. Larkin muttered and stirred from drunken stupor, groping beneath the layers of tattered plastic for his crotch, thinking he had pissed himself in his sleep. He hadn't, but it really wouldn't have mattered to him if he had. Something was poking him in the ribs, and he retrieved the half-empty bottle of Thunderbird. He took a pull. The wine was warm with the heat of his body, and its fumes trickled up his nose. Larkin scooted farther into his cardboard box to where its back propped against the alley wall. It was cold this autumn night, another bad winter for sure, and he wondered if he maybe ought to crawl out and join the others around the trash fire. He had another gulp of wine, letting it warm his throat and his guts. When he could afford it, Larkin liked to drink Thunderbird. It was a link to his boyhood.
I learned to drive in my old man's brand new 1961 Thunderbird, he often told whoever was crouched beside him. White 1961 Thunderbird with turquoise blue upholstery. Power everything and fast as shit. Girls back in high school would line up to date me for a ride in that brand new Thunderbird. I was ass deep in pussy.
All of that was a lie, because his father had never trusted him to drive the Thunderbird, and Larkin instead had spent his teenage years burning out three clutches in the family hand-me-down Volkswagen Beetle. But none of that really mattered in the long run, because Larkin had been drafted right after college, and the best part of him never came back from Nam. VA hospitals, treatment centers, halfway houses, too many jails to count. Why bother counting? Nobody else gave a damn. Larkin remembered that he had been dreaming about Cedar Lane again. Not even rock gut wine could kill those memories. Larkin shivered and wondered if he had anything left to eat. There had been some spoiled produce from the dumpster, but that was gone now. He decided to try his luck over at the trash fire. Crawling out of his cardboard box, he pocketed his wine bottle and tried to remember if he'd left anything worth stealing. Probably not. He remembered instead how he once had camped out in the huge box from their new refrigerator on Cedar Lane before the rains melted the cardboard into mush. There were half a dozen or so of them still up, silhouetted by the blaze flaring from the oil drum on the demolition site. They weren't supposed to be here, but then the site was supposed to have been cleared off 2 years ago. Larkin shuffled over toward them, an identical blob of tattered refuse, at one with the urban wasteland.
What's happening, bro?
Pointman asked him.
Too cold to sleep. Had dreams, had bad dreams. The black man nodded understandingly and used his good arm to poke a stick into the fire. Sparks flew upward and vanished into the night.
About numb? Worse.
Larkin dug out his bottle.
Dreamed I was a kid again, back home, Cedar Lane.
Portman took a long swallow and backed the bottle back.
Thought you told me you had a happy childhood.
I did, as best I can remember.
Larkin killed the bottle.
That's it, Pointman advised. Sometimes it's best to forget.
Sometimes I can't remember who I am, Larkin told him.
Sometimes that's the best thing, too.
Pointman hooked his fingers into an old shipping crate and heaved it into the oil drum. A rat had made a nest inside the packing material, and it all went up in a mushroom of bright sparks and thick black smoke. Larkin listened to their frightened squeals and agonized thrashings. It only lasted for a minute or two, then he could smell the burning flesh, could hear the soft popping of exploding bodies, and he thought of autumn leaves burning at the curbside, and he remembered the soft popping of his eyeballs exploding. Gary Blaze sucked in a lungful of crack fumes and fought to hold back a cough. He handed the pipe to Dr. Sin and exhaled.
It's like I keep having these dreams about back when I was a kid, he told his drummer, and a lot of other shit. It gets really heavy some of the time, man.
Dr. Sin was the fourth drummer during the two decades up and down career of Gary Blaze and the Krays. He had been with the band just over a year, and he hadn't heard Gary repeat his same old stories quite so many times as had the older survivors. Just now they were on a very hot worldwide tour, and Dr. Sin didn't want to go back to playing gigs in bars in Minnesota. He finished what was left of the pipe and said with sympathy,
heavy shit. It's like some of the time I can't remember who I am, Gary Blaze confided,
watching a groupie recharge the glass pipe. They had the air conditioner on full blast, and the hotel room felt cold.
It's just all the years of being on the road, Dr. Sin assured him.
He was a tall kid, half Gary's age, with the obligatory long blonde hair and heavy metal gear, and getting a big start with a fading rock superstar couldn't hurt his own rising career.
You know, Gary swallowed a lube with a vodka chaser. You know, sometimes I get up on stage and I can't really remember whether I can play this thing.
He patted his vintage Strat.
And I've been playing ever since I bought my first Elvis 45.
Hound Dog and Don't Be Cruel back in 1956, Dr. Sin reminded him. You were just a kid growing up in East Tennessee.
And I keep dreaming about that, about the old family house on Cedar Lane.
Dr. Sin helped himself to another hit of Gary's crack.
It's all the years on the road, he coughed. You keep thinking back to your roots.
Maybe I ought to go back just once, you know, see the old place again. Wonder if it's still there.
Make it some sort of bad rocker comes home gig?
Shit.
Gary shook his head. I don't ever want to see the place again.
He inhaled forcefully, dragging the crack fumes deep into his lungs, and he remembered how his chest exploded in a great blast of superheated steam.
Garrett Larkin was dreaming again, dreaming of Cedar Lane.
His mother's voice awoke him. And that wasn't fair, because he knew before he fell asleep that today was Saturday.
Gary, rise and shine. Remember, you promised your father you'd have the leaves all raked before you watched that football game. Shake a leg now.
All right, he murmured down the stairs, and he whispered a couple swear words to himself. He threw his long legs over the side of his bed, yawned and stretched,
struggled into blue jeans and high school sweatshirt, made it into the bathroom to wash up. A teenager's face looked back at him from the mirror. Gary explored a few incipient zits before brushing his teeth and applying fresh butch wax to his flat top. He could smell the sausage frying and the pancakes turning golden brown as he thumped down the stairs. Mom was in the kitchen, all business, in her apron and house dress, already serving up his plate. Gary sat down at the table and chugged his orange juice. "Your father gets back from Washington tomorrow after church," Mom reminded him. "He'll expect to see that lawn all raked clean." "I'll get the front finished." Gary poured Karo syrup over each pancake in the stack. "You said you'd do it all." "But Mom, the leaves are still falling down. It's only under those maples where they really need raking." Gary bolted a link of sausage. "Chew your food," Mom nagged. But it was a beautiful October morning with the air cool and crisp and the sky cloudless blue. His stomach comfortably full, Gary attacked the golden leaves, sweeping them up in swirling bunches with the rattling leaf rake. Blackie, his aged white mutt, swayed over to a warm spot in the sun to oversee his work. She soon grew bored and fell asleep. He started at the base of the pink marble front of the house, pulling leaves from under the shrubs and rolling them in windrows beneath the tall sugar maples and then onto the curb. Traffic was light this morning on Cedar Lane, and cars' occasional whizzing passages sent spirals of leaves briefly skyward from the pile. It was going faster than Gary had expected it to, and he might have time to start on the rest of the yard before lunch. "There's really no point in this, Blackie," he told his dog. "There's just a lot more to come down." Blackie thumped her tail in sympathy, and he paused to pat her head. He wondered how many years she had left in her, hoped it wouldn't happen until after he left for college. Gary applied matches to the long row of leaves at the curbside. In a few minutes, the pile was well ablaze, and the sweet smell of burning leaves filled the October sky. Gary crossed to the front of the house and hooked up the garden hose to the faucet at the base of the wall, just in case. Already he'd worked up a good sweat, and he paused to drink from the rush of water. Standing there before the pink marble wall, hose to his mouth, Gary suddenly looked up into the blue sky. Of course, he never really saw the flash. There are no cedars now on Cedar Lane, only rows of shattered and blackened stumps. No leaves to rake, only a sodden mush of dead ash. No blue October skies, only the dead gray of a long nuclear winter. Although the house is only a memory preserved in charcoal, a section of the marble front wall still stands, and fused into the pink stone is the black silhouette of a teenaged boy looking confidently upward. The gray wind blows fitfully across the dead wasteland, and the burned-out skeleton of the house on Cedar Lane still mourns the loss of those who loved it and those whom it loved. Sleep well, Gary Larkin, and dream your dreams. Dream of all the men you might have become. Dream of the world that might have been. Dream of all the people who might have lived had there never been that October day in 1962. In life, I could not spare you. In death, I will shelter your soul and your dreams for as long as my wall shall stand. What we see and what we seem are but a dream within a dream. From the Peter Ware film of Joan Lindsay's novel, Picnic at Hanging Rock. A Bad Day for Sales. Copyright 1953 by Galaxy Publishing Corporation. Renewed copyright 1981 by Fritz Leiber. So apparently this first appeared in Galaxy magazine in 1953. Read by Goblin Hood. The big bright doors parted with a whoosh, and Roby glided suavely onto Times Square. The crowd that had been watching the 50-foot-tall clothing ad girl get dressed, or reading the latest news about the hot truce, scrawl itself in yard-high script, hurried to look. Roby was still a novelty. Roby was fun. For a little while yet, he could steal the show. But the attention did not make Roby proud. He had no more vanity than the pink plastic giantess, and she did not even flicker her blue mechanical eyes. Roby radared the crowd, found that it surrounded him solidly, and stopped. With the calculated mysteriousness, he said nothing.
Say, Ma, he doesn't look like a robot at all. He looks sort of like a turtle.
Which was not completely inaccurate. The lower part of Roby's body was a metal hemisphere, hemmed with sponge rubber and not quite touching the sidewalk. The upper was a metal box with black holes in it. The box could swivel and duck. A chromium bright hoop skirt with a turret on top.
Reminds me too much of the Little Joe Barra tanks.
A veteran of the Persian War muttered, and rapidly rolled himself away on wheels rather like Roby's. His departure made it easier for some of those who knew about Roby to open a path in the crowd. Roby headed straight for the gap. The crowd whooped. Roby glided very slowly down the path, deftly jogging aside whenever he got too close to ankles in Skylon or Saucissons. The rubber buffer on his hoop skirt was merely an added safeguard. The boy who had called Roby a turtle jumped in the middle of the path and stood his ground, grinning foxily. Roby stopped 2 feet short of him. The turtle ducked. The turret ducked. The crowd got quiet.
Hello, youngster. Roby said in a voice that was smooth as that of a TV star and was, in fact, a recording of one.
The boy stopped smiling.
Hello,
he whispered.
How old are you? Roby asked.
9. No, 8.
That's nice, Roby observed. A metal arm shot down from his neck, stopped just short of the boy. The boy jerked back.
For you,
Roby said gently. The boy gingerly took the red polylop from the neatly fashioned blunt metal claws. A gray-haired woman, whose son was a paraplegic, hurried on. After a suitable pause, Roby continued.
And how about a nice refreshing drink of poppy pop to go with your polylop?
The boy lifted his eyes but didn't stop licking the candy. Roby wiggled his claws ever so slightly.
Just give me a quarter and within 5 seconds,
a little girl wriggled out of the forest of legs.
Give me a polylop too, Roby, she demanded.
Rita, come back here.
A woman in the third rank of the crowd called angrily. Roby scanned the newcomer gravely. His reference silhouettes were not good enough to let him distinguish the sex of children, so he merely repeated,
Hello, youngster.
Rita.
Give me a polylop.
Disregarding both remarks, for a good salesman is single-minded and does not waste bait, Roby said winningly, I'll bet you read Junior Space Killers. Now I have here...
I'm a girl. He got a polylop.
At the word girl, Roby broke off. Rather ponderously, he said, then, after another pause, he continued, I'll bet you read G.G. Jones, Space Stripper. Now I have here the latest issue of that thrilling comic. Not yet in the stationary vending machines. Just give me 50 cents and within five... Please let me through. I'm her mother. A young woman in the front rank drawled over her powder-sprayed shoulder. I'll get her for you. And slithered out on 6-inch platforms. Run away, children, she said nonchalantly, and lifting her arms behind her head, pirouetted slowly before Roby to show how much she did for her bolero half-jacket and her form-fitting slacks that melted into skylon just above the knees. The little girl glared at her. She ended the pirouette in profile. At this age level, Roby's reference silhouettes permitted him to distinguish sex, though with occasional amusing and embarrassing miscalls. He whistled admiringly. The crowd cheered. Someone remarked critically to his friend, it would go better if he was built more like a real robot, you know, like a man. The friend shook his head. This way it's subtler. No one in the crowd was watching the news script overhead as it scribbled, Ice pack for hot truce. Vanadin hints Russ may yield on Pakistan. Roby was saying, in the savage new glamour tint, we have christened Mars Blood, complete with spray applicator and fit all finger stalls that mask each finger completely except for the nail. Just give me $5. Uncrumpled bills may be fed into the revolving rollers you see beside my arm. And within 5 seconds... No thanks, Roby. The young woman yawned. Remember, Roby persisted, for 3 more weeks, seductivizing Mars Blood will be unattainable from any other robot or human vendor. No thanks. Roby scanned the crowd resourcefully. Is there any gentleman here? He began, just as a woman elbowed her way through the front rank. I told you to come back, she snarled at the little girl.
But I didn't get my polylop.
Who would care to?
Rita. Roby cheated. Ow.
Meanwhile, the young woman in the half-bolero had scanned the nearby gentleman on her own, deciding that there was less than a 50% chance of any of them accepting the proposition Roby seemed about to make. She took advantage of the scuffle to slither gracefully back into the ranks. Once again, the path was clear before Roby. He paused, however, for a brief recapitulation of the more magical properties of Mars Blood, including a telling phrase about the passionate claws of a Martian sunrise. But no one bought. It wasn't quite time yet. Soon enough, silver coins would be clinking, bills going through the rollers faster than laundry, and 500 people struggling for the privilege of having their money taken away from them by America's only genuine mobile sales robot. But now was too soon. There were still some tricks that Roby did free, and one certainly should enjoy those before starting the more expensive fun. So Roby moved on until he reached the curb. The variation in level was instantly sensed by his underscanners. He stopped. His head began to swivel. The crowd watched in eager silence. This was Roby's best trick. Roby's head stopped swiveling. His scanners had found the traffic light. It was green. Roby edged forward, but then it turned red. Roby stopped again, still on the curb.
the crowd softly, awed, its delight. Oh, it was wonderful to be alive and watching Roby on such a wonderful day, alive and amused in the flesh, weather-controlled air between the lines of bright skyscrapers with their winking windows, and under a sky so blue you could almost call it dark. But way, way up, where the crowd could not see, the sky was darker still. Purple dark with stars showing, and in that purple dark, a silver green something, the color of a bud, plunged downward at better than 3 miles a second. The silver green was a paint that foiled radar. Roby was saying, "While we wait for the light, there is time for you youngsters to enjoy a nice refreshing poppy pop, or for you adults. Only those over 5 feet are eligible to buy, to enjoy an exciting poppy pop fizz. Just give me a quarter, or I'm licensed to dispense intoxicating liquors. In the case of adults, $1.25. And within 5 seconds, but that was cutting it quite fine enough. That was not cutting it quite fine enough. Just 3 seconds later, the silver-green bud bloomed over Manhattan into a globular orange flower. The skyscrapers grew brighter and brighter still, the brightness of the inside of the sun. The windows winked white fire. The crowd around Roby bloomed too. Their clothes puffed into petals of flame. Their heads of hair were torches. The orange flower grew stem and blossom. The blast came. The winking windows shattered tier by tier, became black holes. The walls bent, rocked, cracked. A stony dandruff dribbled from their cornices. The flaming flowers on the sidewalk were all leveled at once. Roby was shoved 10 feet. His metal hoop skirt dimpled, regained its shape. The blast ended. The orange flower, grown vast, vanished overhead on its huge magic beanstalk. It grew dark and very still. The cornice dandruff pattered down. A few small fragments rebounded from the metal hoop skirt. Roby made some small, uncertain movements, as if feeling for broken bones. He was hunting for the traffic light, but it no longer shone, red or green. He slowly scanned a full circle. There was nothing anywhere to interest his reference silhouettes. Yet whenever he tried to move, his underscanners warned him of low obstructions. It was very puzzling. The silence was disturbed by moans and a crackling sound, faint at first as the scampering of rats. A seared man, his charred clothes fuming where the blast had blown out the fire, rose from the curb. Roby scanned him. "Good day, sir," Roby said. "Would you care for a smoke? A truly cool smoke? Now I have here a yet unmarketed brand." But the customer had run away screaming, and Roby never ran after customers, although he could follow them at a medium brisk roll. He worked his way along the curb where the man had sprawled, carefully keeping his distance from the low obstructions, some of which writhed now and then, forcing him to jog. Shortly he reached the fire hydrant. He scanned it. His electronic vision, though it still worked, had been somewhat blurred by the blast. "Hello, youngster," Roby said. Then after a long pause, "Cat got your tongue? Well, I've got a little present for you. A nice, lovely polylop." His metal arms snaked down. "Take it, youngster," he said after another pause. "It's for you. Don't be afraid." His attention was distracted by other customers who began to rise up oddly here and there, twisting forms that confused his reference silhouettes and would not stay to be scanned properly. One cried,
water.
But no quarter clinked in Roby's claws when he caught the word and suggested,
how about a nice refreshing drink of poppy pop?
The rat crackling of the flames had become a jungle muttering. The blind windows began to wink fire again. A little girl marched up, stepping neatly over arms and legs she did not look at. A white dress and the once taller bodies around her had shielded her from the brilliance and the blast. Her eyes were fixed on Roby. In them was the same imperious confidence, though none of the delight with which she had watched him earlier.
Help me, Roby, she said. I want my mother.
Hello, youngster, Roby said. What would you like? Comics? Candy?
Where is she, Roby? Take me to her.
Balloons? Would you like to watch me blow up a balloon? The little girl began to cry. The sound triggered off another of Roby's novelty circuits.
Is something wrong?
He asked. Are you in trouble? Are you lost?
Yes, Roby. Take me to my mother.
Stay right there, Roby said reassuringly. And don't be frightened. I will call a policeman. He whistled shrilly twice. Time passed. Roby whistled again. The windows flared and roared. The little girl begged,
take me away, Roby,
and jumped onto a little step in his hoop skirt.
Give me a dime,
Roby said. The little girl found one in her pocket and put it in his claws.
Your weight, Roby said, is 54 1/2 pounds,
exactly.
Have you seen my daughter? Have you seen her?
A woman was crying somewhere.
I left her watching that thing while I stepped inside. Rita!
Roby, help me,
the little girl was telling her moments later.
He knew I was lost. He even called a policeman, but he didn't come. He weighed me, too, didn't you, Roby?
But Roby had gone off to peddle poppy pop to the members of a rescue squad, which had just come around the corner, more robot-like than he, in their fireproof clothing. Note, the following story was obviously inspired by Thomas Pynchon's novel Gravity's Rainbow. It appeared in Interzone, number 55, March 1992. World Wars III, by copyright by Paul D. Filippo, read by Goblin Hood. Is history personal or statistical? T. Pynchon. This happened in Hamburg on the eve of J-Day, the night of that now legendary USO triple bill, the Beatles opening for the Supremes and Elvis, sort of a chorus of pop Valkyries the brass had kindly arranged for all us jivey G.I. Joes and jolly Jack Tars before booting us over the edge of the steaming crevice filled with prop dry ice or leading straight to hell into the gaping maw of the massed Warsaw Pact troops, chivied so recently out of West Germany, harried and weary, but far, far from beaten. Half the North Atlantic fleet, it seemed, had put in at Kiel 2 days before for refueling and provisioning. All hands were forbidden shore leave. Scuttlebutt had it, we all, or at least my ship, the USS Rainbow Warrior, would soon be steaming for Gdansk to participate in a humongous amphibious attack which, given the Polish defenses around their shipyards, led by the already legendary young Major Walesa, had about as much chance of success as the Republicans had of beating JFK and Stevenson in the next elections, or Woody Allen had of playing the romantic lead against Sinatra's wife, Mia. Those were our chances, that is, if the patrolling Ruski subs didn't sink us first en route. This prospect did not sit well with Pig Bodine and me. It wasn't so much that we were scared of dying. Gee whiz, no. 3 years of battle had cured us of that childish fear, inoculating us with the universal vaccine known as War Enemy. It was simply that we didn't want to miss the big show down Hamburg way.
I seen the Beatles before the war, said Pig. Right in Hamburg at the Star Club. Man, they could rock. I thought they were going somewhere, but I never heard any more about them. I didn't even know they were still playing together.
Bodine was lying upside down on his bunk, head hanging forward, trying to get a cheap and the only available high from the rush of blood to his head. Physiology recapitulates pharmacology. Above the bunk hung a tattered poster of James Dean and Brigitte Bardot in From Russia with Love. The Prez, that lover of Fleming's novels, had an identical one, only autographed, hanging in the Oval Office. Pig's enormous hairy stomach was exposed below, or more precisely above, his dirty shirt. His navel was plugged with some disgusting smegma that resembled bearing grease and Crisco. Bodine's navel jam fascinated me at the same time it repelled me. Coming from a white bread background, illustrious Puritan forebears and all that, good school and the prospect of a slick entrance into the corporate life at Boeing, I had never met anyone quite like Bodine before. He represented some kind of earth force to me, a troll of mythic proportions liable at any moment to unleash a storm of belches and farts capable of toppling trees, accompanied by a downpour of sweat and jism. I had known Bodine for 10 years now, since I had dropped out of Cornell and enlisted in the Navy in 55. Peacetime, it seems so long ago and so short. 20 years between the first two and 20 more till the third. Had they been planning it all along, just biding their time until the wounds had healed and the people had forgotten? Until the factories could retool to meet the new specs from the R&D labs? Was peace, in fact, like diplomacy, merely another means of waging war? Bodine had been my constant companion through all that time, even when I had made it briefly into officer's territory before being busted back. And that's another story entirely, but one also not entirely innocent of the presence of the Pig, Germanic totem of death. We had been through a lot of craziness together, but even so, even knowing him as I did, I could not have calculated the vector of the madness we were about to embark on now, nor its fatal terminus. I think I heard something about them a year or two ago, I replied, imagining Pig's mouth as occupying his forehead, and his eyes his chin. It barely improved his looks. The guy named McCartney, interrupted Pig. Whatever. He was arrested on a morals charge, got caught with some jailbait, and then his buddy Lennon. All right, already with the teacher rip. Do you want to hear the story or not? Lennon started shooting heroin when the war broke out and had to spend some time in a clinic. This must be a comeback tour.
I could use a little comeback myself, snorted Pig. Left too much in the last port, snurg, snarf, yuck.
This last approximating piggy laughter.
God, I'm going shit crazy. I gotta see that show and get laid. Dig me. Do you still have that shore patrol rig we swiped?
Yeah, why?
Just listen.
And so several hours later, all tricked out, we prepared to breach our own forces' defenses. It was dark, and Benny Yo-Yo Dine, slowest of the slow, was on guard, on duty guarding the gangway. I was wearing the SP armband, harness, and nightstick, and had my sidearm strapped on. Pig was in cuffs.
Halt, said Yo-Yo Dine, brandishing his rifle like some Annapolis Frosh. No one's permitted to disembark.
It's okay, Benny. They just need Bodine on shore for his court-martial tomorrow. Yo-Yo Dine lowered his gun and scratched under his cap.
Court-martial?
Gee, I'm sorry to hear that. What did he do? You know the soup we had last week, the one that tasted so grungy? He pissed in it. They discovered it when they saw the distinctive urine corrosion in the kettles. The captain had seconds and nearly died. Yo-Yo Dine turned 6 shades of green.
Good Christ, what a pig.
Come on, Bodine, it's time to meet your fate. Higgs started struggling.
No, no, I won't go. Don't make me. General LeMay will hang me by my balls.
Yo-Yo Dine prodded him with the rifle.
Quit fighting and take it like a man. You can do at least one noble thing in your miserable life.
Higgs straightened up.
You've made me see the error of my ways, Biddy. Come on, Tom. I'm ready now.
I marched Pig down the ramp to the dock. He exuded such an air of holy martyrdom that I found myself almost feeling sorry for him. As soon as we rounded the corner of a warehouse, Pig unsnapped his shackles from his wrists and collapsed atop a barrel, racked by laughter.
As Bugs Bunny would say, I commented,
"Yeah, what a maroon."
He really thought I was all reformed in an instant. Jesus, some guys deserve the Navy. Let's hit the road, Jack Kerouac.
It was a sweet, warm July evening. We were instantly and unforgivably AWOL, and the King was playing the next night about 100 miles to the south. Uncle Sam and the rest of the Western world was pausing like a punch-drunk fighter between the penultimate and fatal round in a senseless slugfest. A brief moment of mocking peace. To have his mouth spritzed and the blood wiped from his brow before plunging back into the fray with the Pug Ugly, cauliflower-eared Papa Nikita and his robotic commie hordes. I had never felt more alive, nor ever would. Kiel was crawling with SPs and MPs, S&MPs, one and all for sure, striding imperially among the crowds of refugees, black marketeers, NATO, deputized civilian cops, and homeless war orphans, all dandy-eyed in rags and vicious as lampreys as they tried to attach themselves to Pig and me as unlikely saviors. The kids were dressed in Carnaby Street rags collected by swinging London matrons and debs. Polka-dotted caps, paisley shirts, striped trousers, fab gear. Pig and I had to dart from shadow to shadow down rubble-filled alleys into doorways that were all that remained of the buildings they had been attached to, and upstairs, leading to nowhere, to avoid getting orphan-mobbed or cop-trammeled. Using the moon, we worked our way south to the outskirts of the city. On the Autobahn, we were lucky enough to hook a ride with a camo-decorated, canvas-backed Mustang model truck heading Hamburg way. The driver was a blonde English lieutenant named Jane Sugar Bunny Lane. Her cuddly co-pilot was a dark-haired Romanian exile with the handle of Viorica Tokes, now also a member of the British Armed Forces. Ribbons from a double handful of campaigns, the Congo, Panama, Algeria, Finland, Manchuria. Experience these two. Been in more theaters than Hope, Burns, and Burl combined. The gals it developed were also illicitly on their way to the Presley show, having wrangled the assignment of delivering the truck's contents to the big DP camp outside Hamburg. Viorica reached across my lap to crack the glove compartment and liberate a bottle of Swedish vodka, which Pig immediately and immoderately snatched away. I flipped on the truck's radio, tuning for the NATO station, which, once found, proved to be broadcasting a bland diet of anti-war tunes, Streisand singing, a pox on Marx and Lenin too, Barry Sadler with The Day We Took Moscow, Dionne Warwick doing the Bacharach tune, Do You Know the Way to Riga Bay? You dig, I'm sure. I snapped it off.
So what kind of mercy mission is this?
Asked Pig after a swig, squeezing Sugar Bunny's thigh as she drove to ease the crowding. The front door was pushing my service revolver into my hip. I placed my arm around Viorica, whose accented English I found entrancing.
Is that the billy goat pressing my hip, or are you just being glad to see me?
The Romanian babe responded, sending Pig into gales of vodka-scented laughter. When Bodine's snorts tapered off, I repeated his question, rephrased.
Yeah, what's in the bag? Blankets, medicines, powdered eggs?
Sugar Bunny smiled.
Something even more vital, propaganda, namely comics.
My heart nearly stopped.
American? I asked, not daring to hope.
New?
Viorica nodded. Amerikansky comics, yes, and very much recently up to date.
Stop the truck right now. Sensing the urgency in my voice, Sugar Bunny did as I asked. In less time than it takes to tell, I was back in the cab with a shrink-wrapped bundle in my lap. I couldn't believe my luck. This whole crazy misadventure was starting to remind me of an episode of Hogan's Heroes, the one where Hogan talks the idiotic camp commander, Gerasimov, into letting him and the boys borrow a truck to deliver some beets to the borscht factory, and they make a side trip to blow up the tank factory along the way, pulling a truckload of beautiful female young Soviet pioneers out of a ditch. With trembling hands, I ripped the shrink wrapping off. The Fantastic Four had been enlisted on the Middle Eastern front. The sight of the Human Torch zipping through red Egyptian jets, hot metal splattering above the Sphinx, was just what I needed to remind me of the United States media machine I had left behind. The invisible girl fell in love with a handsome Israeli soldier and the thing called clobbering time on a bunch of Russian generals. Meanwhile, Superman was busy in the Pacific, lifting entire commie aircraft carriers out of the sea and dashing them down on the coast of sleepy and ostensibly neutral Japan, inadvertently causing a tidal wave which he then had to outrace before it washed over the ruins of Tokyo. And there was more. The Flash picked up General Westmoreland and rushed him across China just in time to meet Chiang Kai-shek, the Submariner in Australia, Captain America in Tibet, Green Lantern in French Indochina. So engrossed had I become that I barely noticed when the truck pulled off the road into the grounds of an abandoned farm.
Dibs on the barn,
yelled Pig, pulling Sugar Bunny by the hand toward that relatively unscathed structure full of moldering but comfortable and soon to be rolled in hay, leaving me and Viorica to sack out in the ruins of the farmhouse. We unrolled some bedding in the angle of two standing walls and a bit of roof. The air was effervescent on our bare skins, the stars jealous of what they saw. After sex, she told me a little about herself.
I survived conscription work in Soviet munitions factory at Timisoara, until I can take no more. I sneak across the border of my soon-to-be ex-country, then journey through all of Yugoslavia to Adriatic, dodging all kinds of bad men, and swing passage on Hobo's ship, which is sunk off Sicily. For 6 months, I am prisoner of hill bandits who use me like love doll. Rescue comes in a big shoot-up with Britishers, special forces, who are looking for their kidnapped ambassador, but find me instead. I arrive in London just in time for guess what?
Not napalm night.
You bet. Whole city and plenty of citizens burned up by flaming Russian Vaseline. Some kind of big mess.
That about summed up the whole world just then, so we fell asleep. In the morning, we were awakened early by a rooster's arrogant assertion that life was worth living. We tracked him down, found his harem, and rustled up some eggs. The girls produced government-issue Tang and Pop-Tarts, and we had a fine breakfast in the ruins of civilization. Pig ate enough for two. Horses, that is. Back on the road, we raced over the remaining miles to Hamburg. The tanks and trucks and jeeps and APCs we passed were all heading toward the city. No one was leaving. It seemed the entire European theater of operations was funneling into the old Hanseatic city for the big show. Their courses bent like rays of light around the king's sun. We saw teams from all three stateside networks and the BBC. I thought I recognized Walter Cronkite.
"Make me a star," shouted Pig as we zipped by.
The gals dropped us off in the center of the war-torn town well before noon.
We've
got to get these capitalist color catechisms to the people who really need them, boys, said Sugar Bunny.
We'll catch you at the show tonight. Thanks for the company.
Lady Jane, I said, trying my best to sound like Jagger, may I kiss your hand?
She extended it graciously out the driver's window.
You could have had more than that to kiss if you asked, said Pig. Yuck, yuck, snort.
Pig, it would insult the entire species to call you a sorry example of humanity.
Heads up for anti-personnel mines,
Viorica advised as Sugar Bunny shifted gears.
Ivan planted plenty before he retreated.
Made wary by Viorica's parting words, we picked our way gingerly down the center of the empty street, two cautious cocks come to Cuxhaven. What now? I asked Pig.
Get drunk, of course. That was half the reason for going AWOL, remember?
We found a functioning Rathskeller, the Iron Stein, occupying the roofed-over basement of a building that didn't exist anymore. Inside, patchily illuminated, various locals mingled with off-duty troops from all nations. A cadre of Canadians consorted with a flock of Kiwis, while a gaggle of Gurkhas slopped swill with a passel of Portuguese. B-girls and con men lived lower down on the food chain. Pig and I were liberally supplied with occupation script, and we plunked it down on the bar for some of Herr Feldverein's best homebrew. Pig on my right slurped down two Boilermakers to my every one and was soon snoring gently on the bar. I doubted he had gotten much sleep with Sugar Bunny. I myself was at the stage where vision is muzzily enhanced and thoughts flit free as dogs in a Dylan song. The fellow on my left gradually became the focus of my attention. He was an older man, easily past 60, but in good shape, bearded, dressed in a kind of modified safari getup, popular with correspondents and other white guys slumming in foreign climes. He radiated an air of melancholy wisdom, the likes of which I had never felt before. In my boozy condition, I felt it incumbent upon me to try and cheer him up. Mr. Hemingway, I presume, I said, lifting my glass in mock recognition.
Sorry, son, he's got the glamour assignment with the occupying forces in Cuba.
I could tell by his voice that he was completely sober, perhaps the only such soul in the room. You are a writer, though.
Yes, Herald Tribune. And you?
An inexplicable shiver unzipped my spine. Was I misinterpreting his question? And if not, why had he asked such a thing? My uniform was obvious as Senator Johnson's hernia scars, and I had thought none of my bruised karma was showing. I swigged my beer and said,
no, afraid not. In another lifetime, maybe, if I hadn't left school.
He laughed then, as bitterly as I've ever heard anyone laugh.
Another lifetime. You wouldn't want one, believe me.
And how can you be so certain? He grabbed my sleeve and stared me down.
I'll tell you a good story, son, and let you decide. He let me go and then began. I was 18 in 1985. I had to interrupt. 20 years in the future. Your future. Once my present. Now nobody's future. Anyway, shut up. I don't tell this one often and it might change my mind. I was 18 in 1985. And a simple soldier.
The world I lived in was one you probably can't imagine. You see, in my world, the United States and the Soviet Union were both armed to the teeth with atomic bombs. Do you have any notion what those are? Something to do with atoms, I bet, I managed to wise mouth. That's right, explosive devices that split atoms to unleash unimaginable destructive power. They were invented during World War II. They were? In my world, yes, they were. And after the war, thousands were manufactured and mounted on rockets. Rockets now, I said. This is quite a story. I've always liked rockets, but I've never seen any big enough to carry a bomb. A firecracker, maybe. Believe me, they can be built big enough to cross continents. Can you picture such a world? Held hostage by two insane superpowers with enough megatonnage to destroy the whole ecosphere? Megatonnage, I thought. Ecosphere. A madman's glossolalia. But the putative nutcase ran right past my speculations with this story. Well, in 1985, it finally happened. The Soviet premier was Yuri Andropov, a mean bastard, former KGB man. The Russians were losing in Afghanistan. Afghanistan, didn't the British have something to say about that? The British Empire fell to pieces after my Second World War. They meant nothing. No, the geopolitical scene was strictly the U.S. versus Russia. They were the only players who really mattered. Well, the Russians invaded Pakistan, our ally, where the Afghanistan rebels had their bases. We responded with conventional forces, and the conflict escalated from there. The next thing we knew, the birds were launched, and World War III had begun. I was assigned as a simple guard in the command center under the Rockies. That's how deadly those bombs were. We had to hide our asses under the weight of mountains just to survive. Well, in the first few minutes of the war, and it only lasted an hour or two, everything went like clockwork. The generals gave the launch codes to the soldiers manning the silos, read the damage reports handed to them, counted up their losses, and launched a second batch of missiles in response. But then things began to break down. We were still getting a few visual feeds along the fiber optics. The whole atmosphere was churning with electromagnetic pulses, of course, and the sights that we saw. The man began to weep at the catastrophe that hadn't happened yet, and apparently never would. His face was briefly contorted with an intensity of deep emotion. I was rapidly becoming bummed out. This had gone from being a kind of half-amusing, half-draggy conversation with a lively-minded liar or Coleridge-style buttonholing by a certified maniac. Tears in his beard, the old reporter pulled himself back together, obviously drawing on some immense reservoir of will. He caught me by the elbow and I was frozen. His touch had communicated to me the certainty that every word he spoke was the truth as he knew it. The carnage was awful. It drove technicians and soldiers alike mad. Nobody had predicted this. There was mutiny, rebellion, firefights, and suicides in the command center. Some pushing to continue the war, others to cease. I couldn't take sides. My mind was paralyzed. Instead, I dropped my rifle and fled deeper into the enormous bunker. When I came to myself again, I was in a lab. Everyone there was dead, suicides. I slammed the door, locking myself in. There was an apparatus there. It was a time machine. Jesus! I shook his hand off and looked around me for help in dealing with this madman. But everyone was busy getting drunk except Pig, who was still blissfully snoring. I was on my own. Atomic bombs, rockets, okay, maybe. A time machine, though. Do you expect me? I don't expect anything. Just listen. As soon as I discovered what the device was, an experimental one-way, last-ditch project that had never even been tried, I knew what I had to do. I wanted to live out most of the century again, up to the year the final war had broken out. So I set the machine for 70 years in my past, 1915. I figured I could hang on till my 80s, and the second decade of the century was early enough to start changing things. There were spatial settings as well. I put myself in New York, instant transition, instant transition, very elegant. There I stood, dressed all wrong, 18 years old, the tears still wet on my face, but quite certain of what I had to do. Very quickly, I established myself as a reporter. It's amazing the scoops you can deliver when the future is an open book. Then I began systematically killing some very important people. Einstein was first. He had already published some papers, of course, but I staged his death so as to discredit his work as much as possible. Traveling to Switzerland, I carried with me the government-issued poison the lab technicians had offed themselves with. I had grabbed it before entering the way back. Traceless, efficient stuff. It was no problem to slip some into the coffee Einstein and I shared. I paid a Zurich orphan boy to report to the authorities that the Jewish pervert had died during sex with him. Quite a remarkable scandal. No respectable scientist would touch his theories afterwards with a 10-foot pole. Walesa, I half-heartedly quipped. He ignored me. After such an obvious target, I began working through a list of everyone who had a hand in developing either atomic fusion or rocketry. Bohr, Lawrence, Fermi, Dyson, Alvarez, Feynman, Panofsky, Teller, Oppenheimer, Goddard, Sakharov, the Joliet Curies, von Braun, Wigner, Ley, Dirac. I completely wiped out the slate of history. Wiped the slate of history clean of most of 20th century nuclear physics. It was easier than I had ever dreamed. Those people were vital, indispensable geniuses, and so trusting. Scientists love to talk to reporters. I had easy access to almost anyone. The Army had taught me traceless ways to kill, and I used them once my stock of poison ran out. It was pathetically simple. The hardest part was keeping my name clean, staying free and uncomplicated. I visited the victims at night, usually at their homes, without witnesses. I misrepresented my employers, my name, my nationality. Oh, I was cunning, a regular serial killer. Bundy and Gacy had nothing on me, and I eventually beat their score, but for the salvation of the world. None of the names he had mentioned meant anything to me except Einstein's, whom I recalled as a crazy Jewish physicist who had died in disgrace in Switzerland. I had to assume that they were real people, though, and had been as pivotal as he claimed. Why did you have to kill scientists, though? Why didn't you go the political route, try to change the political structures that led to war or eliminate certain leaders? Too much inertia. The politics had been in place for decades, centuries. The science was just being born, and it was the scientists' fault anyway. They deserved to die, the arrogant bastards, unleashing something they could barely comprehend or control like that, like children chipping away at a dam for the thrill of it. And besides, what difference would it have made if, say, I could have gotten someone different elected as president or nominated as premier? Would Russia have gone democratic under someone other than Andropov, released its satellite nations, disengaged from Afghanistan? Bloody unlikely. But still, I didn't neglect politics. I reported favorably on the creation of the President's Scientific Advisory Council that started under Roosevelt and curried favor with its members. I wrote slanted stories ridiculing the notion of funding anything even remotely connected with rocketry or atomic power. Not that there were many such proposals after the devastation I had wreaked. Of course, I kept killing off as many of the second stringers as I could who had popped up to take the place of the missing geniuses. History remained pretty much as I remembered it right up till the Second World War. Nuclear physics just didn't have much impact on life until the 40s. But by the time Hitler invaded Poland, I was certain I had succeeded. There would be no atomic ending to the war. I had staved off the ultimate destruction of the Earth. Naturally, my actions meant a huge loss of American lives in the invasion of Japan, hundreds of thousands of extra deaths, all directly attributable to my intervention in history. Don't think I haven't thought about those men, night after night, weighing their lives in the balance against those of the helpless civilians in Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
and later, every city on the globe. But the scale always tipped the same way. Atomic destruction was infinitely worse. He was talking almost to himself now, more and more frantic, trying to justify his life, and my incomprehension meant nothing. By my side, Pig had stopped snoring. After the war, though, events really began to diverge from what I knew. It all slithered out of my control. The permanent American presence in a devastated Japan led to stronger support of the Chinese Republicans against Mao and his guerrillas, resulting in their defeat. How could I know, though, that having the Americans on their Mongolian border would make the Russians so paranoid and trigger-happy? I couldn't be expected to predict everything, could I? The border incident that started up your World War III, a total freak accident, out of my hands entirely. But what does a little global skirmish mean, anyway? As long as there's no atomic bombs. And there's not, are there? You've never seen any, have you? I could only stare. He grabbed my shirt front. I fucking saved your ass from frying, he hissed. I'm bigger than Jesus. You all owe me, you suckers. I made your world. There was a shot, followed by screams and the sound of clattering chairs and shattering glasses. The time traveler's hands loosened and he fell to the floor. Pig Bodine had my service revolver in his shaky hand. My dad died in the invasion of Japan, said Pig. Bodine, I opined, I think you've just killed God. This is war, man. Why should God get off free? We split fast from the Iron Stein before anyone could gather their wits to detail us. We found Sugar Bunny and Bjorka and shacked up in a safe spot till the show, which we thought it would be okay to attend under cover of darkness. After all we had been through, it would have been a shame to miss it. The Beatles played superbly, especially Pete Best on drums. The whole crowd forgot their J-Day jitters and began to groove. During their last number, a little ditty called Tomorrow Never Knows, I began to cry so hard that I missed all of the Supremes set and the opening notes of the King's Mystery Train. But Presley's singing made my world seem real enough again and more important than ever before. After the concert, the four of us ambled off hand in hand through the nighted streets, lit only by the stars so impossibly high above, where no rocket bearing atomic bombs had ever trespassed. Back toward the truck, now as empty of its four-color contents as my brain was of plants. Yet somehow I felt content. Where to, boys? Asked Sugar Bunny. The future, I said. Where else? Nyak, nyak, snuffled Pig. How about tripping into the past? I'd like to be in that barn again. If you ever get the chance, please don't ever try it, Pig. Living in a world created by a moral idealist is bad enough. One made by an amoral hedonist. I can't even begin to imagine it. The girls were puzzled. Pig sought to explain by goosing them simultaneously so they squealed. Could it be worse, Tom? Could it be? Snurg, snarf, yuck. The Curse by Arthur C. Clarke. Copyright 1953 by Star Publications, Inc. for Cosmos Science Fiction and Fantasy. Read by Goblin Hood. For 400 years, while its fame spread across the world, the little town had stood here at the river's bend. Time and change had touched it lightly. It had heard from afar both the coming of the Armada and the fall of the Third Reich, and all man's wars had passed it by. Now it was gone, as though it had never been. In a moment of time, the toil and treasure of centuries had been swept away. The vanished streets could still be traced as faint marks in the vitrified ground, but of the houses nothing remained. Steel and concrete, plaster and ancient oak, it had mattered little at the end.
in the moment of death, they had stood together, transfixed by the glare of the detonating bomb. Then, even before they could flash into fire, the blast wave had reached them and they had ceased to be. Mile upon mile, the ravening hemisphere of flame had expanded over the level farmlands, and from its heart had risen the twisting totem pole that had haunted the minds of men for so long and to such little purpose. The rocket had been astray, one of the last ever to be fired. It was hard to say for what target it had been intended. Certainly not London, for London was no longer a military objective. London, indeed, was no longer anything at all. Long ago, the men whose duty it was had calculated that three of the hydrohelium bombs would be sufficient for that rather small target. In sending 20, they had been perhaps a little overzealous. This was not one of the 20 that had done their work so well. Both its destination and its origin were unknown, whether it had come across the lonely Arctic wastes or far above the waters of the Atlantic. No one could tell, and there were few now who cared. Once there had been men who had known such things, who had watched from afar the flight of the great projectiles and had sent their own missiles to meet them. Often that appointment had been kept high above the earth where the sky was black and sun and stars shared the heavens together. Then there had bloomed that indescribable flame, sending into space a message that in centuries to come other eyes than man's would see and understand. But that had been days ago. At the beginning of the war, the defenders had long since been brushed aside, as they had known they must be. They had held on to life long enough to discharge their duty. Too late, the enemy had learned his mistake. He would launch no further rockets. Those still falling, he had dispatched hours ago on secret trajectories that had taken them far out into space. They were returning now, unguided and inert, waiting in vain for the signals that should lead them to their destinies. One by one, they were falling at random upon a world which they could harm no more. The river had already overflowed its banks. Somewhere down its course, the land had twisted beneath that colossal hammer blow, and the way to the sea was no longer open. Dust was still falling in a fine rain, as it would do for days while man's cities and treasures returned to the world that had given them birth. But the sky was no longer wholly darkened, and in the west the sun was settling through banks of angry clouds. A church had stood here by the river's edge, and though no trace of the building remained, the gravestones that the years had gathered round it still marked its place. Now the stone slabs lay in parallel rows, snapped off at their bases and pointing mutely along the lines of the line of the blast. Some were half flattened into the ground, others had been cracked and blistered by terrific heat, but many still bore the message they had carried down the centuries in vain. The light died in the west, and the unnatural crimson faded from the sky, yet still the graven words could be clearly read, lit by a steady, unwavering radiance, too faint to be seen by day, but strong enough to banish night. The land was burning. For miles, the glow of its radioactivity was reflected from the clouds. Through the glimmering landscape wound the dark ribbon of the steadily widening river, and as the waters submerged the land, that deadly glow continued. As the waters submerged the land, that deadly glow continued unchanging in the depths. In a generation, perhaps, it would have faded from sight, but 100 years might pass before life could safely come this way again. Timidly, the water touched the worn gravestone that for more than 300 years had lain before the vanished altar. The church that had sheltered it so long had given it some protection at the last, and only a slight discoloration of the rock told of the fires that had passed this way. In the corpse light of the dying land, the archaic words could still be traced as the water rose around them, breaking at last in tiny ripples across the stone. Line by line, the epitaph upon which countless millions had gazed slipped beneath the conquering waters. For a little while, the letters could still be faintly seen, then they were gone forever. Good friend, for Jesus' sake, forbear to dig the dust enclosed here. Blessed be ye men,
yet spares these stones. And cursed be he, yet moves my bones. Undisturbed through all eternity, the poet could sleep in safety now, in the darkness and silence above his head. The Avon was seeking its new outlet to the sea. From the book Nightmares for the Yesterday People and Other Illustrated Stories, copyright 1981 by James Beatty. Reprinted from Subversive Scholastic, number 14, November-December 1979. Artificial Friday, read by Goblin Hood. It was a Sunday morning, bright and sunny, in early September of the last year of the nuclear age. Certainly no one was more aware of this than Kenneth Galbraith, for whom it was also an artificial Friday. He sat frozen to his chair, listening with a deepening dread to the eerie wail of a distant early warning system. There was no real chance that this banshee siren heralded a tornado. The sun was too bright for that, with not a cloud in the sky. Aside from tornado warnings, the only other time when it was normal for Kenneth to hear this siren howling was on the first Friday of every month at 12 noon. This unprecedented phenomenon could therefore mean only one thing, and only for about 15 or 20 minutes or so. Unfortunately, there was no real shelter for Kenneth to go scurrying off to anyway. And so Kenneth Galbraith sat frozen there in his 20th century chair, desperately pretending that it was Friday, and watching the bright, cloudless sky for possible tornadoes. And soon the sky became brighter still. From Beatty's Americana, Volume 1, Number 6, copyright 1990, read by Goblin Hood. An important press release. The other day somebody told me about an alleged U.S. Army plan to send a plane blaring a siren into Hiroshima just before the bomb to get everyone's attention and blind them with the flash. Evidently this idea was scrapped. That night I dreamed that I had invented the first atomic bomb. It was top secret, so I couldn't tell anyone I was going to test it. But I didn't want the test to blind people, so I issued a press release warning people that if they happened to hear any bombs go off, not to look at them. As it would have turned out, according to physics, the light would have preceded the noise anyway. Editor's note. I can't believe this next item myself, but I know I was awake when it happened. I walked into a photo supply store one day. Paul Harvey was yammering away on the radio. I could swear I heard him say something about a top secret plan hatched by the U.S. government during the fabulous 50s, a plan to use atomic bombs on whatever was left of their old arch enemies, the Native Americans. This plan was also scrapped. The fact that we did a lot of our atmospheric testing in places like Nevada during the Cold War can probably be chalked up to stupidity or to a general cold-hearted carelessness toward any Americans living in the area at the time. There weren't that many Redskins around by then anyway. Can any Paul Harvey fans confirm this? I either heard it or imagined it in 1983, I believe. And now the rest of the story. From Beatty's Americana, Volume 1, Number 5. Star Wars, or The Life of the Party. Saturday, 1/7/89, circa 1 p.m. I was alone in the world, but not alone. I was at a party where the refrigerator was full of bologna sandwiches. This was ironic because I couldn't eat anything without aggravating my stomach ulcer. There were plenty of other attractions, though, such as three TVs blaring, each on a different channel. Actually, there were two parties going on here. Upstairs were the dopers, all crammed into various closets, abusing various substances. I looked in up there and was fearful that the huge crowd would cause the floor to collapse.
Downstairs was wall-to-wall with undercover narcotics police who had all, unfortunately for them, stupidly worn the same ridiculous hippie costume. Nobody wearing this costume was allowed upstairs, not even to use the bathroom. I saw one guy pissing in his shoes. At a loss, they were haplessly trying to bust each other. But then we all went outside for some reason. It was early evening and the stars were already out. You could see the Columbus skyline from the porch, and everyone on the street was out watching a great spectacle unfolding in the sky. Many were hysterical. One man furiously demanded cigarettes from me. He started to wrestle with me, but then fell to the ground weeping. In the sky, two vast armadas of spaceships were fighting. They seemed unreal, like 3D holograms projected in midair. I turned to watch the crowd behind me and suddenly noticed a bright searing flash at my back. Turning, I saw an incandescent green glow fading behind some buildings. Everyone was reacting strangely. Many of the narcs were now abusing substances and some of the dopers were making citizens' arrests. Many people were frolicking naked as though dancing in the streets during the plague years. Then to my left I saw another bright flash, this time an orange hemisphere of light. As it faded to the breakaway point, I perceived in its center a huge mushroom cloud rising above the skyscrapers. I woke up knowing that this was the end. Right. And, it should be almost the end of this tape about nuclear war, which was designed to be listened to while the nuclear explosions get painted into the triptych. The first two stories are sort of self-explanatory, though I lived through the Cuban Missile Crisis myself, and so the first one is particularly poignant. Reminds me of events in Goblin Hood Satyricon. The third story sort of echoes statements made in the essay Libby's Monument by Beatty, which explains about Goblin Hood preventing nuclear war and how that would make Goblin Hood responsible for all the conventional carnage that goes on. And then these last three things, or four things, or whatever they are simply, you know, filler, I guess. Artificial Friday's interesting because there's a legend that it had to be printed in Detroit because the protagonist of the story, you know, had accidentally been named the same as some local bigwig, and so the printers around Columbus were afraid to do the issue. I don't know how true any of that is, but I know that Beatty had to, you know, well, wound up going to Detroit along with the publisher to get the thing printed. So for the rest of this, Beatty's Americana, you know, what can I say? I mean, what tripe, huh? Something like what